We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
300 pounds. Mark Matney is an orbital debris scientist with NASA. He says even as the reentry gets closer, researchers won't know exactly where it will come down.
The path of the debris field is something like 500 miles long. So even if you could identify the general area, you couldn't identify the specific place where the different pieces are going to fall.
But NASA has calculated the risk of anyone getting hit, and it's extremely low. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
That's heavy rain from a powerful typhoon that's lashing Tokyo today. The storm has knocked out power to more than a quarter of a million homes and businesses. The typhoon now bearing down on Japan's tsunami-ravaged northeast coast. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Intel, sponsors of Tomorrow, in areas including retail, energy, transportation, and education. More at intel.com/inside.
The planned power reduction of AM580 for tower work is expected to occur sometime tomorrow so that the next phase of our tower repair can begin. You may be unable to hear AM580 for as long as 2 weeks. The program service on FM 90.9 will not be affected. And you can hear AM580 online at WILL.illinois.edu. We apologize for this inconvenience and thank you for your patience as we work to bring you a much improved AM580 signal. Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls.
We're talking today on Focus with Professor Fred Donner from the University of Chicago. He's professor of Near Eastern History, and we're going to be talking about his current book, Mohammed and the Believers. Welcome, Professor Donner.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
It happens that today is the United Nations International Day of Peace, September 21st. As I read your book, talking about the origins of Islam, it struck me that your book could be seen as a contribution to a more peaceful understanding between religious groups. Did you ever think of it that way?
Well, it's a relief to learn this. of course, this has occurred to me. It occurred to me when I first had this sort of believers to Muslims idea back in the 1990s. But that wasn't why I had the idea. It was just a serendipitous sort of side benefit of this, what I saw as the most reasonable interpretation of what had happened at the beginnings of Islam.
Before we get into the thesis of your book that's indicated by its title, starting out as a group of believers before eventually becoming, perhaps over even a century, seen more as a religion. What drew you initially just to the study of history?
Wow, that's a tough one. Usually people ask me what drew me to the study of Middle Eastern history.
Sure.
but history more generally is harder to say. I guess it was the, I started off actually to study, went to college to study the sciences. I sort of thought I was going to be a chemist.
And that was at Princeton?
That was at Princeton, yes. Yeah. And I was lucky to go there because it's a place that has huge, great wealth of faculty in many different fields. So when I realized that I wasn't really good enough in math, I sort of ran into a wall with differential equations and linear algebra. I wasn't doing very well in my math classes. And while I enjoyed thinking about physical chemistry, I was never getting the right answer on the problem sets. And at the same time, although I had enjoyed lab chemistry in high school, I somehow hated it when I got to college. And I also thought, what do I want to do with my life? Do I want to spend the rest of my days working in a chem lab somewhere in New Jersey, which is what I imagined I would be doing? And I said, yuck, no, I don't want to do that. What do I want to do? I want to travel, and I'd like to really learn to speak a language well, because I'd enjoyed languages in high school. And at the time, I was taking courses in art history, actually, course on ancient art that covered ancient Near Eastern art as well as Greek and Roman, which is what I thought it was going to be about. And I got quite interested in the ancient Near East and the history of the ancient Near East. That sort of drew me simultaneously into history and into the study of the region that we call the Near East or the Middle East. So it was kind of a package deal that I came to, and it took me a long time to shift from sort of ancient Near East to medieval Islamic, but I ended up settling on that as I learned more about the history of the region.
Now, you ended up staying at Princeton for your doctorate.
Well, yeah, I came back, actually. Ah. It was kind of a boomerang event.
Where did you go in between?
Well, I spent a couple of years in the Army. I graduated from Princeton in 1968, and it was pretty hard to avoid the Army at that time.
I remember.
So I was taken in for a couple of years and fortunately was stationed in Germany, which was very good for my German, which I had studied in college, thank goodness. And then I spent another year in Germany studying at the University of Erlangen, studying Near Eastern languages and history and so on, and then I came back to Princeton to do my PhD.
And your concentration then was what?
Well, it's interesting. When I left, when I took my BA, my concentration, my diploma says Oriental Studies. When I came back and took my PhD, it's called Near Eastern Studies because the Department of Oriental Studies had divided in the meantime into a Department of Near Eastern Studies and a Department of East Asian Studies. So the older department had them combined, and then after a while they were split. So I had two different titles, but it was really the same, many of the same staff members that I worked with.
And by now, even the term Near Eastern is not without problems.
Well, especially Middle Eastern, I think.
Sure.
There are people who argued that the term Middle Eastern is somehow tainted because it was first used by a naval historian in the early 20th century talking about the projection of American power around the globe, and he identified a certain part of the world as the Middle East, and that was the first time. That's sort of the genesis of the term. But, you know, I don't have such problems with the term. Yes, it's a relative term, middle in relation to what near and far, and,
sure.
You know, but every culture, beg pardon?
And from what perspective, sure.
From what perspective, yes, one can argue these things. On the other hand, everybody knows where it is now. We've been using
exactly.
It for a century or so. And if you try and think of what the alternatives might be, they're so cumbersome and confusing that they're not really practical. I know State University of New York at Binghamton has what they call their SWANA Center, Southwest Asia, North Africa.
Right.
Well, this is more, we might say, geographically descriptive of the region that we usually call the Middle East, but how do you make an adjective out of this
in a
convenient way? You know, we say Middle Eastern culture, but you want to say Southwest Asian, North African culture. It's a real mouthful.
It's very difficult.
Another dimension to this, which I find interesting, is that people forget that words like Africa and Asia are themselves actually imperial or colonial terms. It's just it's from the Roman Empire. They forget that Africa was the term originally, Provincia Africa was originally the territory that the Romans conquered from Carthage in what is today Tunisia, and then by extension it became the whole continent behind it. And Asia similarly was a kingdom, the kingdom of Pergamum, that was willed to the Roman Empire when its last ruler died without children, and he willed his kingdom to the Roman Empire, so that became the province of Asia, and then by extension the whole, that was a little kingdom on the Mediterranean in what's today Turkey. By extension, the term was applied to the whole of Asia, the whole of the continent. So even Asia and Africa have kind of tainted colonial or imperial roots, and we've just forgotten about it. And I suggest we forget about it for Middle East, too.
That little bit of information, though, is a great example of why it's so much fun to talk to a historian and why history matters.
it's really nice of you to say that. It's fun to talk to historians. I love hearing that.
Before we get into the real focus of the program on your book, Muhammad and the Believers, tell us from your perspective as a professional historian, what are some of the other things you've gained from the study of history sort of generally? Why is it important? Why does it matter for you as a person living today? And, of course, by extension, to your students and our listeners.
I think the thing about the study of history, if you do it conscientiously, and you don't have to be a professional, of course, there isn't that much, there aren't that many jobs for professional historians. But anybody can be a competent historian. It means you have to read carefully and you have to think carefully about relationships and not engage in the kind of sort of snap associations or quick associations bridging hundreds and sometimes thousands of years. You have to try to see relationships of cause and effect and not sort of look at superficial similarities. It requires you to to think systematically about the past, which means also about the present. And I think that, you know, when we read the headlines and when we read a lot of what's in the popular media, especially about Islam today, there's an awful lot of it that would qualify. It looks maybe to the non-historian as like it's as though it's historically grounded. It's a kind of overview. But in fact, it's simply jumbling together a very selective group of factoids, we might say, pulled from the historical record and put together as a kind of pastiche that looks like it has the compelling quality of an argument. But when you think about it more carefully, you realize, well, we can't really go from this point A to this point B. There's just too much in between that doesn't add up, that doesn't, you know. Or we realize that, yes, some of these facts that are being adduced are true, but there are other facts that are just as relevant or maybe more relevant either that the person simply isn't touching on. And, you know, if you're an historian, you have a responsibility to look at all the evidence, not just the evidence that supports your case. If you only look at the evidence that supports your case, that makes you a polemicist.
We're talking on Focus today with Professor Fred Donner from the University of Chicago. His area of expertise is Near Eastern History. His most recent book is Muhammad and the Believers at the Origins of Islam. Let me remind listeners, you may join the conversation. In fact, we're eager to have you ask questions. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the guest host for this program today, but I'm happy to have others join in. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area where our studio is, punch in 333-9455. If you're where it's a long-distance call, you may use the 1-800-222-9455. That's a toll-free call. And that includes if you're listening on the Internet anywhere in the continental U.S., you can punch in 1-800-222-9455. And, of course, if you have to miss part of this program, you want to hear it later at your convenience, you can go to the website will.illinois.edu/AM, and you can search for this program on the website under Focus. Professor Donner, you've talked about why you got interested in this area, the Near East, but why this particular period?
Well, maybe that's also an interesting question.
I hope.
I got interested in the Islamic period rather than the ancient Near East, it was a long struggle for me to choose which I wanted to do. Was I going to be a Mesopotamian archaeologist or was I going to be a historian who worked on the medieval period? And I decided that the material about the medieval Islamic world was somehow more accessible to me. It seemed a little less alien. There were more sources available, although that may seem ironic given that I end up working on the 7th century where there are hardly any documentary sources. But that aside, I was drawn to the medieval Islamic world. I had started to study Arabic because I figured I'd be working in the region and I could start to read the Arabic sources, which were the ones of primary importance for this field, at least for the early medieval period. And so that sort of drew me into the medieval Islamic period. Early Islam itself, that is the rise of Islam, I got into for a somewhat different reason. I was thinking at that time, so this would have been, you know, sort of between college and graduate school and roughly 1968 to 71, something like that. I was thinking sort of in my spare time about what it was that made the history of the Middle East as a region and the cultures of the Middle East different from those of Europe. I was aware, of course, that there was a lot of work about the history of Europe and the medieval period and the ancient period and medieval and modern. That was a well-developed field of history. The field of Middle Eastern history was quite different. And somehow when I read the treatments of Middle Eastern history, I wasn't always very satisfied with them. It somehow there seemed to be something missing. And I asked myself, what is it that makes this part of the world so different? And I think a lot of scholars who've worked on the history of the region have asked that. And I decided that I had become interested in social history at that time, and I decided that one of the really crucial variables in the history of the Near East was the long-term sustained presence of pastoral nomads in most Middle Eastern societies, their contact with settled peoples and settled cultures. There are, of course, some nomads in the history of Europe, of Western Europe, but they are far fewer. We think of the Germanic migrations, but these are not nomads. These are people sort of moving into a new place and settling down. Whereas in the Middle East, from remote antiquity, as far as we can tell, there have been groups of people who live essentially a partially or sometimes fully nomadic life. They don't have fixed habitations. They live in tents, and they move around following the grass as with the seasons and using that to sort of sustain their flocks, and then they live off their flocks. And they developed over many centuries interesting set of symbiotic relations with the settled communities, the villages, and sometimes the cities and towns, sort of among which they circulated or around which they circulated. So I thought this theme of nomad-sedentary relations was one that was really important and that bore closer examination than I thought it had received. So I embarked for my dissertation on a study of the expansion of the early Islamic State, as it's usually called, sometimes called the Arab conquest. I don't think that's a very good term, but it's so common that one can hardly avoid it. But I looked at this because it seemed to me that this was a process in which the pastoral nomads were deeply involved as agents of this new state that had formed in Medina, led by Muhammad's followers. And I wanted to try to understand what the relationship was between the state and the pastoral nomads, because as I understood it, pastoral nomads usually had a kind of hostile relationship to the state. So that was what drew me into the early Islamic period. It was actually a question of social history and the fact that we have, for that period, a lot of sources that actually tell us about where these nomadic groups are, which particular tribal groups are in which place or are serving in which army. Whereas when you go 100 years later, you don't get that same kind of fine-grained information about which tribal groups were contributing to what and where they actually happened to be.
Professor Nutter, we do have a call on line number one. Let's go to the caller from Urbana. Yes, you're on the air.
Yes. Professor, would you explain this, what I feel is an impasse between Christianity and the Muslim religions, in that America, of course, stands for equality of all the races, and yet Sharia law puts women as second-class citizens. They can't vote. They can't run for public office. They can't drive. And on. Is there a way, is there a middle ground where people can agree to, Christians and Muslims in this regard?
The short answer is yes.
Can you tell me how?
The more interesting question is how.
Yeah, I mean, how? They're second-class citizens, the females are second-class citizens. In their society, I just don't see how it can be absolved.
Well, I think you're assuming that Islam is one sort of monolithic and unchanging thing, and that there aren't different voices and different possibilities for interpretation. That's not true. I mean, we shouldn't speak about Islam as one thing, but rather Islams, because I think there are as many Islams as there are Muslims. That is, everybody interprets or can interpret the core texts of the faith in a variety of ways, which is, of course, true with Judaism and Christianity as well. In the Islamic tradition, it's true that there has been developed over many centuries this body of religious law, which is usually called Sharia, but it is not monolithic. There are many dissenting voices, and there's no – it's sort of a consensus-constructed thing. There's no organism or organ that can, like the papacy for Christianity, you know, or Catholic Christianity anyway, that can issue what is official doctrine for Islam. It's a question of what different religious scholars decide upon. And so you have always dissenting voices among that scholarly elite, and there's no reason why Muslims can't construct a much more supple kind of approach to religious law if they wish to, and many have, in fact. There were, you know, first of all, we have to remember that you say women are second-class citizens in the Islamic tradition, but I don't think that's really quite fair because they can't vote. I mean, women couldn't vote in this country until, what, 1919 or something? It's not that long ago that we also held women, in a sense, as second-class citizens. So we, in the long-term historical view, this is it's a little blip in terms of time. I'm not trying to suggest that there isn't in many traditional interpretations of Islam a big problem with the way women are treated. I think that's true. If you look at the way the Taliban want to treat women, it's, in my view, it's atrocious. But that's not Islam. That's a particular interpretation of Islam. And if you were to go to a very conservative Christian seminary or a Jewish seminary with certain very conservative people in those faiths, you'd find similarly restrictive sets of values for women, I think. Maybe not quite as restrictive, but very restrictive.
Or perhaps
on the other
hand,
you can also find very liberal interpretations of Islam, as some of them put forth even 100 years ago by noted scholars like Muhammad Abduh, who argued for the complete equality of women in society. Now, that hasn't been taken up uniformly or by every state. Certainly in Saudi Arabia, you don't find it, although there are changes happening there now, too. I just saw an article about the king posing with a whole group of women for his photograph, which never would have happened 20 years ago. And he's pushing the religious establishment there to loosen up in this respect. So, you know, one suspects this is a question of time. But you certainly, I mean, you say women can't hold public office, women can't drive. Well, they can in most Muslim countries. I think actually we haven't had a head of state in the United States, right, who was a woman. We haven't had a president who's a woman, but Pakistan has. So this construct of Islam as something which is inherently or innately or unchangeably hostile to women or not in touch with the modern world is just wrong. I mean, it's true that there are Muslims who construct things in that very conservative way, but that doesn't mean that that's the way Islam does it or has to do it. And I think it's up to Muslims themselves, and I think to decide how they want to lead their lives. And most Muslims, I think, are much more moderate than the firebrands that seem to occupy most of the airwaves, at least the ones that the press in the United States seems to want to give the most attention to.
I thank the caller for the question. We have two others waiting. Let's go to now to a caller on line number two from Champaign.
Hi. Yeah, I enjoy your concept of pastoral nomads. I've spent a good deal of time traveling in the Arab and Muslim world. And in 1986, I was invited on a lecture tour over in Libya. So I went over there for 2 weeks, traveled all around. And, of course, before I went, I read everything there was to read, and it really made no sense to me exactly how Libya operated. I went back again in 1988 on another lecture tour all around. I continued reading, and finally I came across a British professor of anthropology who wrote a very fine book. He had lived over in Libya, and he had looked at the situation, and he said, look, Colonel Gaddafi is a Bedouin from the desert, and he's comes from a pastoral nomadic background, and he runs Libya, this modern, you know, wealthy nation state, as if it were a Bedouin tribe. And then it all made sense to me, the way Libya as a state, as a society, at least under the Gaddafi regime works. I was wondering if you had any thought on that. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll have to conjure up a thought. I mean, I haven't thought about this specifically because, you know, I work in the 7th century, not the 20th or 21st. It is an interesting observation that Gaddafi sort of reflects the pastoral values of his upbringing, not surprising, I suppose. One might see this in some other places as well. You certainly wouldn't see it, I think, in Egypt. But in Saudi Arabia, one suspects also, that there are that tribal, shall we say, tribal and pastoral values may be stronger. One of the things that, though, we have to be realistic about is that while pastoral nomadism, of course, it's a way of life that sort of fired the Western imagination, the noble Bedouin of the desert or the Arab of the desert and so on, sort of a romantic figure, I think, in the minds of many Westerners in the 19th and early 20th century. But that's this kind of pastoral nomadism was a very sophisticated technological response, we might say, to extremely harsh environmental conditions. It enabled people to live in areas where there wasn't enough rain for farming. But you could still live there by taking your flocks there and having them exactly at that place for the 2 or 3 weeks when there was grass in the spring, and then moving when that grass was grazed off or dried up to another pasture land somewhere nearby. And you had to know the cycle of the rains and the cycle of the grazing ground. So it was a kind of, adaptation technologically, using the technology of grazing to sustain life in a place that otherwise couldn't sustain it, because you can't farm there and you can't just put your flocks there for the whole year, because most of the year there isn't enough grass for them to eat. But we have to accept that by now this kind of pastoral nomadism is virtually extinct. The arrival of the internal combustion engine, the automobile and the truck and so on, has pretty much done it in. And also one of the things about pastoral nomadic societies that interested me was the fact that they, in traditional times, states were and their power bases were always in settled regions, and they could extend their power from settled regions, and they had a hard time extending their power into the steppe, into the desert. Pastoral nomadic groups could therefore sort of be kind of challengers to the state. They could be autonomous politically from states, and there was often a real rivalry between these pastoral nomadic groups and settled states in the regions that they were close to. And efforts to sometimes bring the other under control and so on. What happened in the beginning of the 20th century with the arrival of the internal combustion engine, the airplane, and also effective weaponry, was that the military power or clout of these pastoral nomadic tribes was completely negated. They could be hunted down in the desert now by people in cars or in airplanes. Cinematic depiction of this in the movie Lawrence of Arabia. But that's a reality that has happened in the 20th century, during the 20th century. And so pastoral nomads kind of lost their both their political basis for autonomy and independence, their pride of autonomy and so on, and at the same time their economic role as providers of certain kinds of hair and hide and milk products and so on and meat was diminished and replaced by sort of more factory-type production of livestock and so on. So the pastoral nomadic lifestyle has, largely disappeared, I think, from the Middle Eastern scene. And now, for example, in Saudi Arabia, the camels are still taken from pasture land, but they're taken in Toyota trucks from one grazing ground to another. So it's a very different kind of life than it used to be.
Professor Donner, we're about halfway through our program. Mm-hmm. Let me, for the sake of listeners who've joined us more recently, say again that you are the author of Muhammad and the Believers at the Origins of Islam, a book published by Harvard Press just out this year, a very interesting book, nicely illustrated with maps and photographs of archaeological digs and other things that make it quite a fine book to have.
Thank you.
To read. We have three callers waiting, so I know Wonderful. We haven't gotten much into
I'll try
your,
to be quicker
into your book.
Answers.
No, it's quite all right. we haven't gotten much into your book, but let me try to state very quickly what I take to be its thesis. So, And then we'll get to these callers. But you argue that at its origin, what became the religion of Islam began as a group of believers who were very open in some ways to being ecumenical with Jews and Christians that they encountered during that 7th century. And it was only later that the focus on the Quran and the focus on Muhammad as the last prophet, the final prophet, that it coalesced into what we might call a religion as opposed to a movement. Am I being fair to your thesis?
I think so, yeah. All right. It was a religious movement, I would say, at the beginning of the sort of monotheistic reform movement.
A monotheistic reform movement led by Muhammad, but great. Well, let's then go to some more of our callers that are patiently waiting. On line number three, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Well, you've pretty well answered the misrepresentation of Islam by the previous caller. But I would like to point out how we've evolved over the last 150 years. In 1850, a woman who married a man lost all claim to her property. It was his, even if she were to divorce him. I don't think that was ever the case in Islam. She had her property, and it remained hers.
Mm-hmm. We conveniently forget some of these facts about our own past. When people construct polemics, they tend to do this.
It's only 150 years that we've mm-hmm. come as far as we have, and we haven't gone far enough. A majority of our legislators are still male, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and a majority...
The overwhelming majority, we might say.
Yes. I was trying to be ironic, of course.
Well, you know, it is ironic that we imposed, I think, on Afghanistan what... In their constitution, they have to have 25% of their legislature has to be women in Afghanistan.
We should
impose it on ourselves.
Yes. Actually, I think historically women had more rights in Afghanistan than they ever had under the Taliban. I also would want to point out that Muhammad's wife was a businesswoman. That is his first wife. And I believe she was literate.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is what tradition tells us.
There's this long tradition of, one might say, feminism in Islam. So perhaps I've made enough points. Oh, yes, the irony that most often the people who accuse anti-feminism among the Islamic people are very conservative Christians who are hardly to be considered feminists themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I thank you.
Thank you very
I do have a question. Have you ever looked at the... the pastoral peoples north of Iran, namely the Scythians, the Mongols, and the Turkish people, because there is a long tradition of these people in fairly well-organized groups. And I would hope perhaps you might look at that someday. It seems to me a neglected field.
Thank you for your comment and questions. Appreciate it.
The whole history of the Near East, in some sense, has long been a neglected field. It's less neglected now than it was when I started out 30 or 40 years ago. And there are people who look quite closely now at Mongol and Turkoman pastoralism and pastoral life and relations of those pastoral groups that are not what we call Arab pastoralists. But yes, and it's actually quite important. There are many different kinds of pastoral groups in the Middle East. The Arab of the Desert is a familiar figure to most Americans, I think, even if only as a caricature. But there's also tradition of pastoral nomadism in Iran and in Anatolia or Turkey, as we call it today, usually. A different kind of pastoralism with different groups of people. Of course, they don't speak Arabic, but they move from low pastures in the wintertime to high pastures in the summertime for their grazing. And so this general phenomenon of pastoral nomadism, I think, historically was extremely important in shaping the cultures of the region.
We have another caller waiting on line number one from Champaign. Go ahead.
For those of us who don't know much about Islam, could you touch on who Muhammad was, The religions he was exposed to as he was growing up, did he have exposure to Old Testament and or New Testament? And how exactly Islam came to start? And I'll listen off the line. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
You're welcome. Well, Muhammad is traditionally said to have been born, and I say traditionally here, we're relying on Muslim tradition written 100 to 200 years after his death. So there's a certain amount of back projection, and that's the challenge for people like me, for historians who work on this period, is to figure out how much of the later tradition we can trust. But for better or for worse, since this is the picture that believing Muslims accept pretty much, and most scholars have also accepted until recently pretty much, I'll give you a summary of what comes from the tradition. According to tradition, he was born sometime in the latter part of the 6th century, so say somewhere around 570 or before that date sometime, the dates are uncertain, in Western Arabia. He's said to have been born in Mecca. That's a town in Western Arabia. Tradition presents him as growing up in a society that was tribal, that was organized by tribal groups in the town of Mecca, and being involved in the commerce of the city, and presents the environment in which he grew up in religious terms as being one of paganism, that is, polytheism of some kind.
So he might not have been exposed at all to either Jewish or Christian scriptures?
Well, on the other hand, the tradition also tells us that in the city of Medina, Yathrib was a few hundred miles away, to which he went later in his career, in that town there were large Jewish communities. And when we look at the Quran text, which I take to be a very early text for the most part, although there may be some interpolations in there, but it looks to me to be a very early text. So something we can say tells us what the thought world of the earliest believers were of the time of the Prophet and his immediate followers. We see a lot of evidence of familiarity. It's clear that these people were familiar with many of the stories from the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. Certainly the Hebrew Bible stories we see in fragments in there. And they're in there in ways that suggest they're not being retold exactly, or they're not being told as one would tell a story for the first time to people who don't understand it. They're being retold to an audience that clearly knows the story already. In other words, the stories are being kind of referred to, and a moral lesson is being drawn by referring to these apparently familiar stories from the Hebrew Bible or from the New Testament. So we have to conclude from that Muhammad, who is the person who starts this religious movement, as I see it, a kind of monotheistic reform movement, that he was in some way exposed to these ideas from the Christian and Jewish traditions. We still don't know the exact extent of the presence of Christianity and Judaism in the Arabian Peninsula at this time. As I say, the tradition itself says that there were large Jewish communities in Yathrib, a few hundred miles north of Mecca, and in many other towns, Khaybar and Taima and so on, and other towns in northern Arabia. We read also in the Yemen in South Arabia, we know there were Christians in South Arabia. We know that in East Arabia along the Persian Gulf, there were Jewish and Christian communities. So it does look like Christianity and Judaism were familiar probably to many people in the Arabian environment. We can't think of this as a complete backwater. Muslim tradition tends to emphasize the pagan backgrounds, and that may have some validity to it, but we also have to understand that this Muslim tradition's intent is to show the Prophet as bringing monotheism to an unbelieving people. If they were already monotheists in some way, then it wouldn't be as compelling a story, so that they may have, shall we say, overemphasized the degree of paganism in Arabia in Muhammad's environment. In any case, that, for the benefit of the caller, that's sort of the general picture of this person, Muhammad, sort of becoming really concerned about the question of religious ideas, beginning to propagate a more stringent kind of monotheism, insisting that people be properly monotheistic, really only recognize one God, recognize that God is their creator, that God gives them through his grace whatever it is that we live on and so forth. Also a belief in the last judgment. And then he starts this kind of religious reform movement, which after his death spreads very rapidly. Now my hypothesis, drawn from some Quranic evidence and some other evidence, is that this movement, because it basically advanced ideas that were familiar, monotheism and the Last Judgment, and the need to live righteously in accordance with revealed religious law, such as you find in the Quran or also in the Gospels or in the Torah, that some Christians and some Jews were included in this believers' movement, that they had, you know, they could accept these ideas. They believed them themselves, and so they were part of the original movement, and that it's only about 100 years later that Islam kind of redefined, that is, the believers' movement, the leadership of the believers' movement redefines itself and says, no, only those of us who follow Quranic law and who take the Quran as our scripture and the prophet Muhammad as our prophet, we're the only ones who are really believers. And they kind of define the Christians and the Jews at that point out of the movement. That's a process we are still trying to understand.
And you point out in your book, Muhammad and the Believers, that in the Quran itself there are over 1,000 references to the term believers and less than 75 references to the term Muslims, those who submit. We have another caller waiting on line number 3. Let me give the numbers for other people who'd like to join the conversation, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455, or you can communicate by email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's go to line number 2. Yes, you're on the air.
Hello. I would like for you to talk about why you think the term that's widely used, Arab conquest, is inappropriate. It seems to me that this is another misapprehension of that period of history, that as the earlier caller, there's an irony that maybe fundamentalist Christians are the part of the group that talk about women's rights. It's also, considering the history of Christendom, the Crusades, the very explicit conquest of South America and the New World and Philippines, and with the cross being following the sword sort of thing, that it's particularly bizarre that that's so widely held. If you could elaborate on that.
Thank you for the call.
Let's go to the term Arab conquest. I expressed my reservations about it before. The problem with the term, from my point of view, is that it suggests somehow that the conquest or the expansion of this state was something that was driven by what we might call nationalist ideas. We all today, of course, when you hear the word Arab, if you're a Westerner, it means something to you, and it means a people. You know, it means a nationality, kind of an ethnicity, whatever you want to say. But the expansion of the believers' movement in the 7th century was not driven, in my view, by any kind of ethnic or proto-national identity. It was driven by religious ideas. And when you call it an Arab conquest, it kind of just ignores and dismisses and downplays the religious component to the movement. Now, we also have to emphasize, though, that this was the expansion of a state. So we don't want to just say that it's the expansion of a religion, because what's interesting is that once the believers take over areas, they don't seem to require people to convert. They're not forcing people to convert to the new religion. They're interested in establishing a public order, we might say, in which they could conduct, which believers could observe their religion and in that way attain salvation, they thought. But they weren't insistent on forcing other people to become believers in the same way. They were simply expanding. But when you say Arab conquest, as I mentioned before, it seems to emphasize, you know, you'd expect, if that were an accurate term for the expansion, you'd expect, for example, in the Quran to find all kinds of references to the Arabs as a people, or, you know, you don't find any of that in the Quran. There's no emphasis on any kind of ethnic identity as having privilege or being in any way special. The only thing that matters is whether you believe in God or not and whether you live righteously or not. That's what's important in the Quran. So I think the term Islamic conquest is better, although it's what I used in an earlier book which I wrote called The Early Islamic Conquest. Although now my thinking has moved on, and I'm wondering whether Islamic is right either, because it's a believers' movement at the beginning, and so maybe we should call it the Believers' Conquest. That sounds a little vague. Anyway, I leave it at that.
We have another caller, this time on our toll-free line, number 4 from Indiana, Prairie Creek, Indiana. Yes, you're on Focus.
Hello. I have two questions, and I'll hang up and listen. Number one, how did the crescent moon become the icon for the Islamic faith? And number two, to what extent was Muhammad a military leader? Thanks a lot.
Appreciate the call.
Thank you. Well, the first one, I really have no idea how the crescent moon and usually a star with it becomes the emblem. It's certainly well established by the Ottoman period.
I don't know either, but perhaps one of our listeners who does will call.
That's possible. As for the second one, was Muhammad a military leader? Well, again, we know what we think we know about Muhammad from the Muslim tradition itself, which is written later. And it presents him as being, of course, the leader of his nascent community of believers and a prophet who received revelations from God. But it also presents him as leading campaigns against opponents of the his community, particularly against different tribal groups that he wanted to sort of incorporate into the community, and other, and also particularly against the city of Mecca, his hometown, that had sort of thrown him out, or from which he had fled to go to Medina or Yathrib to establish his independent community. So yes, he is presented as a military leader to some extent. The question is whether this is what actually happened, or was this because the Muslim tradition of a century and two later was trying to construct an image of a proper prophet, and that some proper prophets like Joshua and others were military leaders, and that, you know, if you're going to make a picture of your prophet as a proper one, you have to show him as a military leader. So we don't really know. This is a historiographical issue. But if we go from the tradition, yes, he certainly did lead some campaigns.
And you mentioned in your book that there's also the difficulty of looking at the source, the sources, and determining what's legend and what's based on reality, because there are so few documents from that place in the 7th century. The difficulty of knowing whether he was really an orphan, or is that just so fit in with Moses? those kind of issues are very difficult for historians. We have other callers.
Okay.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say the source problem really is the nub of our problems when we try to deal with the life of the prophet and the early history of the Islamic community or the believers movement, because we don't have – we have hardly any true documents from that period. Everything else is mediated by later opinions and transmitters. And even the few documents we have often don't agree with each other. We get contradictory information from those. So we – you know, as historians, we there's no – you have no choice but to engage in a certain amount of speculation.
We're talking with Professor – Fred Donner from University of Chicago, author of Muhammad and the Believers, published by Harvard Press. We have several callers waiting. A very provocative discussion, but please keep your comments or questions short. We're down to our last several minutes. Line number one, you're on the air.
Good morning. Are you primarily a religious scholar, or do you also study the broader cultural institutions like government, et cetera?
Oh, I'm definitely a historian, you know, interested in the whole society and what's going on in it.
Okay. Well, certainly, but your focus was the Middle Ages.
Well, I worked on the period from, you know, as I said, I started on the 7th century and the expansion of the Islamic State, because I thought this would give me a window into the relations between pastoral nomads and state systems or settled societies.
Yeah. Well, could you comment then on their concepts of individual liberty? They certainly must have changed from the 7th century to the Middle Ages. And then were they primarily influenced by outside cultures to, you know, liberalize their ideas? Or, and also, could you comment on the institution of slavery? Because I know it was active. They had an active slave trade in Africa in the 19th century when the British were there, it extends even further into a modern era.
We have only a couple minutes. Professor Donner, do your best.
Okay. Well, there's a lot on the plate there, and I can't get over it at all. The whole question of liberty, individual liberty, is that's such a contemporary American and recent American phrase that it's very hard to project it back into the political or intellectual history of any much earlier period. I don't think probably anybody in before the 10th century would have even understood what you were talking about if you brought it up to them. But certainly Muslims, even in the Sharia, are given a lot of individual liberty. They are considered responsible for their own behavior, and generally speaking, they're not to be messed with in their own homes and so on, so they have a lot of liberty. As for slavery, just to touch on that very quickly, yes, slavery was an institution throughout the Mediterranean and Asian worlds, I think, in pre-modern and ancient times and into the medieval period. It was accepted by everyone. Jesus accepted it, and Muhammad accepted it too, as something that was not probably – it wasn't something you could change. It was just taken for granted. But it's very interesting that Muslim tradition comes down very clearly on the idea that while slavery is a legal institution, it is also an undesirable thing, and it is meritorious to free slaves.
Let's try
so
to get
there's a kind of pressure to get away from it.
Let's try to get in one more caller quickly from Chicago, line 4.
Yes, hello. I have a question on the naming of mosques. Like the name of the mosque in New York is going to be the Cordova Mosque. I understand that this was the site of a battle in Spain or a victory in Spain, and is that related to the concept of a victory mosque?
I would doubt it. It seems to me that the idea of a Cordoba mosque, or first of all, I think it's supposed to be like a social center or something. It's not a mosque technically. But the name Cordoba, of course, is a city in Spain. It's been there since Roman times, as I understand it, and which became the capital of the Muslim government in Spain when the Muslims ruled Spain from the late 8th century until, well, parts of it anyway, from the 8th century up until the end of the 15th century. And one of the things that's usually said in Western scholarship as well, about the Muslim rule in Al-Andalus in Spain was that it was noteworthy for the convivencia, for the living together of the three faiths, Christians, Muslims, and Jews. So when the people in New York wanted to call this the Cordoba Mosque or the Cordoba Islamic Center or something, I think they were trying to suggest that this was going to be a place that would be ecumenical. I think actually their board of directors is supposed to include Christians and Jews and other people as well as Muslims too. So they're obviously making an effort to be ecumenical in that attempt to establish this Islamic center in New York. And I think the name Cordoba Mosque was intended to reflect that, not to reflect some kind of victory.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to stop here. We've run out of time, but perhaps stopping on that ecumenical note calls us back to one of your main points in your book, Muhammad and the Believers at the Origins of Islam. We've been talking with Professor Fred Donner from the University of Chicago, and I want to thank him for spending time with us on the air and our many callers today. I want to also thank the technical director at University of Chicago, Eric Fay, for this use of this very high-quality transmission line. And, of course, Jason Croft, technical director here in the studio at WILL. Focus is produced by Harriet Williamson. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for Keeping the Faith, but happy to help out today.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website. Anytime that you're ready to listen, just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Foundation on the U of I campus. McKinley is accepting nominations for its annual Social Justice Awards, honoring local individuals and organizations. For award details and tickets to attend the October 9th banquet, see mckinley-church.org. Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Corn and wheat futures are slightly higher today as end users were taking advantage of bargain prices in what has been thus far a thin and choppy trade ahead of a possible action by the Federal Reserve to stimulate the U.S. economy, that to come out this afternoon. Meanwhile, soybeans slightly lower today as harvest continues to progress. As we're looking and waiting on the Fed, the Reserve Chair, Ben Bernanke, at 1:15 Central Time, is expected to announce further steps to stimulate the staggering and stagnating U.S. economic recovery. Let's go ahead and look at particulars as we head into the final hour or so toward the closing bell, hour and a half or thereabouts. Let's begin over in the wheat pit in Kansas City.